Now we're in our sermon series on Abraham, and this is the third and final Sunday of that sermon series. And in this series, we are trying to prepare our hearts and minds in order to hear the next sermon series, and you can actually think of it that way all the time. Every Sunday is preparing you for the next Sunday of your life. And this Sunday, we're trying to prepare our hearts and minds to hear Galatians. As we go through the chapters of Galatians, listening to what does it mean to walk by the Spirit? In order to do that, we're hoping to listen to the sermons on Abraham, that the text of Abraham will form and shape us with the foundation to be able to hear Galatians well. Last week, we paid attention to how far God is willing to go in his redemption plan. His plan consisted of land, people, and blessing. The people idea starts with Abraham, a direct line, but there's a theological distinction that happens. No longer is it by direct descendants from Abraham. It initially was, but the plan is much bigger and broader than that and includes people of all ethnicity and people of all descendants, not just from Abraham. And then similarly with land, it starts with a direct, specific land, but this expands in God's view throughout the biblical text, becomes a theological category that includes all land and all creation. And then blessing. Not as the world views abundance, but God's abundance is never separated from dependence upon him. It wasn't ever meant to be blessing that removes the need to be dependent upon God. And most importantly, last week, the text showed us how God is committed. How far is God willing to go in his redemption plan? He's willing to take the consequences of the failure of the covenant between God and humanity. If that fails, God's willing to take the consequences on himself to make sure that the promise is held up. So what are we going to do today? Today we're going to look at this text in Abraham and see, how does this work out in our lives? We're going to pay attention to what happened after last Sunday, what happened in the text that followed from Genesis 15 up to this point. How do we act now that we've heard God's commitment to us? How do we live in light of his promise? And so we come to this text, Genesis chapter 20. What I want to do is first pay attention to the context. Where does this text fall in the story of Abraham and Sarah and their relationship with God? And then we'll take a look at Abraham's actions, and then finally turn, how does God deal with this all? Through this text, what's important is to figure out what's the one question we're supposed to be asking. And with this text, I think the question we're asking is, can God be trusted? If there is the great fall that the text reveals to us from Genesis for the chapters that have come before, the great fall and humanity is in jeopardy. We're in a serious predicament. Sin is here among us and in us. How is God going to fix that? Well, he promises to do it through one man and then through his people and then to all people. Can God be trusted with this redemption plan? This text invites us into paying attention to that question. So first, the context. How has Abraham responded when he heard God's commitment level? He had that deep dream and the animal parts were split and then the smoking pot representing God goes through it. Abraham wakes up from that deep dream and of course, like all of us, he goes out and does everything in true dependence and trust on God, right? You know these stories, not so much. Immediately following chapter 15 is of course chapter 16. And the first thing Abraham does is he says, I'm going to take my servant girl and I'm going to try to have a baby with her because she's Sarah's servant girl. So if I have a baby with her, then that's like it's our child and that can be the child that fulfills the promise that God has for us. My wife's servant is as good as my wife. God says, that's not quite exactly what I was hoping you'd do. So chapter 17, God says again, I promise you, you're going to have incredible number of offspring. And he gives Abraham and Sarah new names to reflect the promise that will be fulfilled in them. And Abraham laughs. Abraham laughs at the idea. And he laughs at the idea not because of himself, no question there. He knows that he can do it. He actually laughs because, God, have you seen how old my wife is? You're joking. At that time, God promises that he has 12 to 16 months before Sarah will have a baby, somewhere in that range. Chapter 18, three beings visit Abraham. And then they tell Abraham again, you're going to have a child in due season. And Sarah laughs this time. Oh, no, I didn't laugh, she says. The being said, oh, yes, you did laugh. After chapter 18 comes Sodom and Gomorrah. You know these stories, probably. Abraham pleads with God, if there is 50 people in Sodom and Gomorrah, would you save them for the 50 people that are righteous? I know it's really evil bad there, but if there's 50 righteous people, would you save it? And God says, sure. Well, I mean, if there was five less than that, would you, you know, destroy just for the lack of five, God? I mean, wouldn't 45 be enough? Yeah, okay, 45 is fine. How about 40? Sure, Abraham, fine. 40 is enough. If there's 40 righteous people, I'll say 30, 20. Abraham goes probably further than most of us go when we're pushing God. He takes it down to 10. God, if there's 10 righteous there, will you save Sodom and Gomorrah? Yes. There was not 10 righteous in Sodom and Gomorrah. But God chooses to save Lot and Lot's family. And he does this because he remembers Abraham, the text tells us. So Lot is saved from the hands of God because God cares about Abraham. This is God's response to what's happening in the world. And we're going to carry on with this story now. We've come to chapter 20 in order to see a little bit further, how does the chosen one of God respond? Seeing how God acts in the world, seeing how God has promised him, how does the chosen one respond? But our attention, again, I'll go back to that question, it's not Abraham's behavior that is our major focus. Our major focus is, can God be trusted? What's his behavior? So as we pay attention to what Abraham does, remember, that's not our focus. Our focus is God's behavior. What is God trying to protect here? What is God trying to defend in what happens in this text? God is trying to protect the promise. He has promised Abraham that through Abraham, all nations will be blessed, and it needs to first happen through his descendants. If it was just through Abraham, all nations will be blessed, but not through your descendants, then it doesn't seem as connected to Abraham anymore. Then we're not really sure, from Abraham's perspective, if God can be trusted. So in order for God to be trusted, this needs to come through Abraham's descendants before it expands to the whole earth. It seems to be rather a slow progress, beginning with one person and then one people, one land and then all lands. In Galatians, as we're going to get to that next series, Paul tries to explain that question. Why did we start with just one person? And why did we have the law before we had Jesus? Why all of that? And I think we can answer that quite simply here before we take it on in more depth there. God, why did you start with just Abraham? Why do you need to be shown faithful, God? Are you able to be trusted with the way you treat this one man before you fix the whole problem? And I think the answer is because the problem isn't like fixing a car. When your car breaks down, you figure out what part is broken, you get a diagnostic to happen, and then you replace that part. And if the car itself is, you know, you figure out, is the value of the part worth more or less than the value of the car? And at some point, you're going to decide, you know what, I'd like a new car, I'm just going to replace the whole car. That doesn't work when you think about what's wrong with humanity. It's not as simple as fixing a car. And so the way God goes about fulfilling his promises and his redemption plan, he's trying to protect and cherish something that is existing within humanity that he wants to preserve and expose for us to see and experience. It has to do with our relationship with him. It has to do with his relationship with us and creation. It has to do with our understanding of love. And it'll take your whole life to try to understand and experience what God is trying to preserve in humanity. Every sermon I preach is trying to explain what God is trying to preserve in humanity and show us about himself. So it's a slow process. It's not like fixing a car. But this is what God is trying to protect and defend. He's trying to show us who he is, and he's trying to protect and defend his promise to redeem humanity and expose himself and his love for us. Chapter 20. Abraham tries something. Interestingly, he tells us, Abraham does, that he tries this everywhere we go. Did you notice that in the text? when he's confronted. He says, yeah, this is a practice that I actually do everywhere we go. We're only told about this in one other place. So in Egypt, when there was a famine in the land, Abraham goes down and he does the same ploy. This is my sister. And he does it for the same reasons. And he comes away again wealthy. If he's doing this everywhere he goes, he's kind of using Sarah and his relationship with Sarah as a way of, well, getting wealthy because God's going to protect me, right? Doesn't look great for you, Abraham. What happens from Abraham's actions? Well, Abimelech is put in jeopardy. God actually warns him, you and all your people will die because of what Abraham has done. You are now in incredible jeopardy. Notice that the sins of the chosen people of God put at jeopardy and create the opportunity for the non-Christians to sin. The people of God, if they are not faithful, if they sin, they can actually make it more of an opportunity for those who don't follow God to sin. That's incredible to think about. So Abimelech is rightly upset here. He says, what have you done? How have I sinned against you, Abraham, that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? Time for a confrontation. And he uses one of my most favorite parenting lines. I've actually stopped using it because it doesn't work. It's still one of my favorite, though. It runs in my head every time. What were you thinking? Like, how did you think that was even a good idea? Why are you carrying things that way? Of course it's going to fall and break. What were you thinking? It doesn't work, though. Abraham faces the confrontation, and he responds, well, they did it because, you know, the people here don't fear God. In the text, who shows any fear of God? When Abimelech is confronted by God, his response is one of fear. Whoa, 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 please don't destroy me and my kingdom. Abraham shows fear of Abimelech. Abraham isn't actually scared of God. And when we hear that language, fear of God, it actually means more than just, you know, I'm scared God's going to smash me. It means I have respect for who God is and what he's called me to be. Abraham does not show respect for who God is and what he has called Abraham to be and do. He doesn't trust God. He doesn't have that kind of fear that actually means trust of God. Abimelech, though, does. He does have fear of God. He does realize, actually, I'm in danger here, but at the same time, I recognize that I'm innocent, and I trust that God will respect and pay attention to that. This is a full fear of God. How would it be in our life if, instead of like Abraham, how would it work in your life if you operated in such a manner that you were fear of God motivated, rather than fear of, you know, am I going to get the promotion I think I deserve or not? What if you went in your life and thought, well, instead of, you know, I'm worried that this is going to happen. I'm worried that this is going to be the downfall of my family. And instead you were, I'm worried, I'm respecting how God is going to provide for us. Fear of God should be the way that we make our decisions rather than fear of Abimelech. What is Abraham concerned with protecting? I first wanted to identify what God is protecting and at what cost. So God is protecting the promise and the cost. Last week, he's willing to take that on himself. What is Abraham concerned with protecting? Himself. At what cost? Well, he's actually willing to have Sarah bear that cost, isn't he? And he's willing to have Abimelech bear that cost, isn't he? And he's actually willing to have God's honor, because if Sarah goes into Abimelech and then shortly gives birth to Isaac, whose child did she give birth to? God's promise is actually at jeopardy here. Abraham is so concerned with himself, he's willing to sacrifice Sarah and Abimelech and God's promise and his honor. Sometimes we can justify ourselves in our actions by saying, well, I'm trying to actually protect the promise because, you know, I'm the Abraham of promise. I'm the person who's supposed to be the one blessing all nations through me, so I need to stay alive. I'm the hero, you know, plot armor, if you will, in the story. I need to stay alive. So the rest of you are all supporting characters in my cast, so you're actually sacrificial. You're going to be, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm the hero. So some of us can feel that, you know, all of us can feel that way from time to time. And it's important to remember it's not your job to protect the promise. It isn't Abraham's job to make sure that he stays alive in order for God to be shown faithful. That's actually not Abraham's task, right? Most of the time when we look at our actions, like Abraham's here, we pay attention to them better in hindsight. In the moment, it's hard to wrestle with all this and say, well, gosh, you know, I'm acting out of fear of my boss, not fear of God. Or I'm acting out of fear of the way the economy is wrecking things, and I'm not acting out of fear of God. We don't operate that in the moment. We usually do it in hindsight. I think that's fair to say. Abraham gets caught and doesn't really act so well when he gets caught. I'm going to take a little aside here. The text I'm trying to show us and move us towards, you know, can God be trusted? But I'm going to do a small aside on how to act when you get confronted. This happens in your life sometimes. Sometimes the person you love the most says, hey, you didn't do the thing I would have liked you to do. You're confronted. Sometimes in our life, we don't get confronted by a specific voice or somebody actually sharing with us, but we see, oh, I was in the wrong there. Confrontation happens. How should we behave? And do you know how to apologize? We're all adults here. We should know how to apologize. But we don't. Abraham is the wonderful example of somebody who doesn't apologize. Notice he doesn't apologize in the text. So this isn't a bad apology. This is just simply not an apology. But we use all of these as ways when we say, I'm sorry, but. What does Abraham say back to Abimelech when he's confronted? These are the things not to do when you should be apologizing. First, I did it because I thought there is no fear of God in this place. What did he just say? I did it because you're pagans. So tricking these people is actually okay. They're not as valuable as the chosen people of God. They're lesser humans. So we can do this as well. In different ways, shapes, and forms, we can actually say, you know, I'm sorry, but that person actually doesn't deserve my moral best. The other person doesn't deserve my moral best. You make me so angry, so that's why I behaved that way. I threw the dish and broke it because you made me angry. We're actually lowering the other person. They don't deserve my moral best. We're finding some way to do that. But we can also do this based on ethnicity or race. We can do this based on somebody's class or status. I'm sorry, but you just don't deserve my moral best. And we'll use other words for it, but that's what we're saying. We don't actually mean to apologize there. The other person does deserve your moral best. And you're also not just being moral for them, but for yourself. Because if you are not being morally good with them, it will poison you and poison your heart. Secondly, what does Abraham say after that? There's no fear of God in this place. They will kill me because of my wife. Notice he's not worried about his wife. He sees the jeopardy to himself. This is when we say, I am sorry, but I was in jeopardy, so I had to act that way. There was potential cost to me. There was risk to me, to my person, perhaps just to my comfort, and so I didn't. Instead, I did this. I'm sorry, but I would have had to get up from the chair. So that's why I didn't do the dishes, right? It can be small, but it can be huge. I was scared for my life, so I was willing to sacrifice yours. The other person is not sacrificial for your safety or for your comfort or for your pleasure. Do not say, I'm sorry, but. Third, Abraham then says, besides, she's actually kind of my sister, you know, same father, different mother, so it's like sister, wife, you know, so I didn't even really lie, really, I didn't. I'm sorry, but my crimes aren't, you know, very big, they're actually really small, and it's not really a crime anyways. If you really pay attention to the small minutiae and little details, it's not really, I mean, that guy, that was a big crime. When we say, I'm sorry, but it's just a small thing, you shouldn't get so worked up over it. The perpetrator isn't actually sorry when they tell the victim it's not something that's actually a wrongdoing. Your crimes are crimes, regardless of the amplitude. And then number four, lastly, Abraham has run out of excuses. He's used them up, if you will. And he says to Abimelech, God caused me to wander. Because I am wandering, and don't forget who made me wander, I told you. Because I'm wandering, I am now an isolated stranger, and I'm super vulnerable. And so we're justified at every place that we go to. And so every place that we go to, I say, this is my sister, Sarah. And she says, this is my brother. So it's actually God's fault who made us vulnerable here. I'm sorry, but actually somebody else told me to do it. We're not actually admitting we're sorry, are we? We're trying to pass the blame. This was the first thing Adam did when he was confronted by God as well. Adam, why did you eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And Adam says, the woman you gave me. Just want to slide that in there, God, so you pay attention here. And you did that. How quick and easy it is for us to say, I'm sorry, but do you know it's actually not my fault? It's someone else made me do it in some way, shape, or form. We find these different ways. I'm sorry, but the other person isn't worth my moral best. Or I'm sorry, but I was at risk, and so I had to do what I had to do to protect the risk to me. Or I'm sorry, but it was so small, it doesn't really matter anyways. Or I'm sorry, but someone else, God, told me to do it. We're trying to find a way of saying it's not my fault. We're not actually sorry. So don't make your sorry have those excuses, or you're not apologizing. What's the result of Abraham's bad behavior and horrible excuses? What happens here? Well, Abimelech gives gifts to Abraham. Not what I would have expected. God spoke to Abimelech, made his whole kingdom barren, and threatened him with death. Abraham then gives gifts to pay off the man who does not fear God, who is not acting like he fears God. Previously, Abraham would not take gifts when he made a conquering thing to rescue Lot from trouble. Abraham says, no, I won't take any of the plunder because I don't want to let men make me rich. Only God can make me rich. Here, Abimelech, he receives gifts from Abimelech. Abraham has fallen low in this moment. And Abimelech, as another result of Abraham's actions, he then speaks to Sarah, and he addresses her directly. We don't have this a whole lot in the text, you know, direct address or talk to the woman. But here, Abimelech speaks directly to Sarah, and he says, I have given silver to your brother, exoneration before all who are with you. You are vindicated. This is an incredible honor to Sarah, and it is an incredible honor to the promise, so that everybody knows that the promise is actually not in jeopardy. When Isaac is born, we know who the father is. And then verse 21, chapter 21, verse 1. A result of what happened here, or what happens next. The Lord dealt with Sarah as he had said. The Lord did for Sarah as he'd promised. This strikes me hugely every time I read it. We so talk about the promise to Abraham. The Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. Who's in danger in this story? And if this was a Sunday school class, I'd be asking you to kind of give me your responses. You know, who's in danger in this story? Well, it's Abimelech's in danger, right? And Sarah's in danger. Those are the people who are in danger. And who's the villain in this story? Abraham's the villain, isn't he? He's the one who's putting other people and the promise in jeopardy. And who gets rich? Who benefits out of this story? Well, Abraham does, again, sadly. Who receives honor and glory in this story? Sarah does. Sarah's the one who comes away vindicated. Sarah's the one who comes away with God fulfilling the promise to her. Don't feel that Sarah deserves it either. She doesn't behave well if you pay attention to earlier chapters and the way she deals with her servant woman. But as we come to the conclusion of this text, and we see how God is trying to protect and defend his promises, do Abraham and Sarah deserve God's favor? No, they don't. God is willing to work with them in spite of their faithlessness. And in fact, he's going to use their faithlessness in order to further his purposes. And he does that later in Genesis as well. We shouldn't be surprised when Joseph is thrown into a pit, but then he goes into Egypt in order to prepare a place for the people of God to come and be safe from the famine. You meant it for evil, but God re-meant it for good. Similarly with Israel, God will work with them in spite of their faithlessness. And he will use their faithlessness in order to reveal more of who he is. Ultimately, there is only one faithful person in Jesus Christ. The faithlessness of all the others is used in order to show us who Jesus Christ is, in order to reveal God through Jesus, in order to reveal God's love, so that we can know that God can be trusted. In and through Jesus, we see the fullness of God's redemption plan. His great wisdom, wherein he speaks from the cross, "Forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do." This looks foolish, doesn't it? To incredibly bless and favor those who do not deserve it. This was a horrible thing to do, especially in the Greco-Roman world where Jesus was. This is a horrible thing to do, to give incredibly good gifts to those people who do not deserve it. You're supposed to give gifts to those people who deserve it and will use it well. But in spite of their faithlessness, God blesses, protects, and redeems. God will use even faithlessness to reveal his love, to reveal his mercy, and his goodness. Because it's not like fixing a car. Instead, it's a new creation. Instead, as we begin to participate in the reality that God invites us into through the fulfillment of his promises through Jesus Christ, we get to experience what it means to walk in his power and in his presence. It's an incredible gift to be able to do this. And the stories of Galatians, the letter will invite us into that reality. The letter will invite us into what it means to walk by the Spirit, connected to that power and presence of God, so that we can be participating in this fulfillment of God's promises, and so that we can see God alive and at work in our world. Come, and let us see what he is doing. Amen.